From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The U.S. economy continues to hemorrhage jobs at a staggering pace. The Labor Department said today that the number of people filing new jobless claims hit 4.4 million last week, bringing the total over the last 5 weeks to 26 million Americans. For more, let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Ali, when you put the numbers another way, that means approximately 16% of the American workforce is now unemployed, unheard of levels since the Great Depression.
Right. We've far surpassed 2009, the recession, which was 10%. These are not official rates. The official unemployment rate for America is 4.4%, but that's because we haven't measured anything past the middle of March when the stay-at-home stuff started going to effect. So when you look at the jobless claims, where you get that 16% number, if you add up all of this year, unemployment claims so far through the middle of April are almost 29 million people. Now, just to give you some perspective, in 1982, the entire year, that was a bad year, it was a recession, was 30.4 million people filed for unemployment claims. 2009 was the second worst, the recession, 29.8. We're going to overtake both of those numbers within a week. So by the end of April, we will have beat everything until the recession. This is, it's just, there's no historical comparison to this. It's these numbers are at a scale we're just not used to seeing.
When you look at who has lost jobs, a Pew study found 52% of low-income families have someone who've lost a job, compared with just 32% of higher-income families. Why are some workers struggling more, and do you think layoffs will start to happen more equally the longer this drags on?
No, unfortunately, the difference between now and the last recession is that this is disproportionately hitting people who, I mean, look, recessions always hurt people who are the worst off, the lowest wage earners, the ones who are not on contracts, the ones who can easily be laid off. The distinction between now and the last recession is more women, because of the types of work that is stopped, more women are being laid off. Obviously, the hospitality industry is very hard hit, and those are people who earn particularly low wages because in many cases they were augmented by tips. But believe it or not, hospitals are slashing staff. 43,000 health positions were slashed in March. That's the worst that we've seen in more than 30 years. Lots of other things. Keep in mind the things that aren't happening, right? Waste management, garbage collection, warehousing, education, scientific industries, a lot of technical things that aren't happening. So it's across the board, but it is disproportionately affecting low-wage earners.
And what kind of strain is this putting on state governments? Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said yesterday that states should consider bankruptcy. Today, Michigan's Governor Gretchen Whitmer said that's irresponsible. But all these unemployment claims has got to be putting a lot of pressure on the states.
Yes. And unlike the federal government, which can go into debt and print money, states can't do that. States can't go into debt. They can issue bonds for particular projects. They're building a bridge or a dam or something like that. But they can't go into debt, nor can cities. So the only option for states and cities is to cut expenses. Now, cutting expenses means the things that you get, your garbage collection, police, ambulances, at a very time when we don't need that. But there's an estimate that states could be $500 billion in the hole over the next 2 years because of the extra costs and the lower revenues that they're getting because people aren't working.
That is Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Ali, thanks as always.
My pleasure, Jeremy.
There's also a battle brewing between several governors who have pushed to reopen states and city mayors who are adhering to guidelines that experts say will slow the spread of the coronavirus. In the state of Tennessee, the governor says the vast majority of businesses will be allowed to reopen on May 1st. And joining us to talk about this is John Cooper, mayor of Tennessee's capital and biggest city, Nashville. And Mayor Cooper, models from the University of Washington say Tennessee should wait until mid or late May to reopen. Your governor is talking about next week. What are your plans to reopen? Is that really too soon for Tennessee?
Well, boy, all models are wrong, but they're quite informative. We in Nashville have, you know, data is variable, but we've had a lot of good news. You know, yesterday we had only 26 new cases. Today is a lot more than that. What is the average on a weekly basis? We're all working together. We have to have a restart, and the restart has to be safe, and not a restart that gets undone by improper implementation. In Tennessee, metro cities are allowed to have a little bit of a different path, but we're all basically on the same schedule. We're hoping to be a few weeks away from a phased restart, and the early phases will still be pretty tough until a data-driven trigger happens into gently moving through the different phases to where we can mostly all get back to work.
I want to ask you, though, about the tough times that you're talking about in the reopening. Are you worried at all about Nashville hospitals bearing the brunt of reopening? I mean, people from outside of your county getting sick and coming to Nashville for care.
Well, I, of course, am. It's one of the conditions for being able to talk about reopening. But right now in Nashville hospitals, we only have 60 or 70 cases. Now, this is a blessing because a few weeks ago we were talking about opening a 1,400-bed emergency center, which nobody believes is needed in the current environment. Now, if there's a trigger and we relapse, then, of course, we need to go and do that. But you're in a city here where you don't have that many hospitalizations. We're completely blessed. We've only had 22 deaths in Nashville. That's a tough thing to say only, but if you look around the country, that is only. Figuring out how to restart in a gentle and safe manner is a good, timely project. The trick is to get the public to understand you can't get to the first phase unless you have the metrics that allow you to do that. And the daily test reports are a report card on all of us.
You know, like other cities, you're facing incredible economic pressure as tax revenue drops. You've proposed a property tax hike to make up for that, which would be as high as 20%. You had previously voted against a property tax increase. How did you decide that that was the right solution?
You decide things when you have no choice. We have a multi-$100 million budget hole in Nashville. We're based on sales taxes from hospitality to a big degree, so the loss is particularly severe. And ultimately, local governments have to have balanced budgets. You can't borrow money. We're not getting federal help for this. I mean, I think
would you like to have more federal government?
Oh my gosh! Well, they've put out federal help, but they left it on a shelf we can't get to, under conditions that do not help cities repair their budget problem in paying for police and teachers. And so a lot of cities are having to go to layoffs. We're going to take a path here of protecting our employees, getting ready for a restart. We hope it's sooner rather than later. Now, we have a very low property tax here in Nashville also. So we can raise our property tax and still be competitive. But we're doing it because there's no choice. We had a lot of financial problems before this, and then this has just pushed us over the edge.
That's Nashville Mayor John Cooper. Thank you so much for this
update. Thank you, Tanya.
Well, throughout history, artists have depicted viruses in creative and sometimes cartoonish ways to make sense of something we can't see with the naked eye. NPR's Netta Ulaby reports on how we picture disease.
Back when we first started anthropomorphizing something invisible, people did not even really know what disease was. So they used the images that made sense.
Little figures of demons that were physically attacking the body.
That's Jared Gardner. He's a professor who studies medicine and popular culture. He says the Grim Reaper and similar images were first used to represent disease, as well as pictures of the pain disease caused.
Like little dogs biting your feet for gout, for example.
Gout, cholera, yellow fever. The way we pictured these diseases changed once we understood germs. But when the so-called Spanish flu hit in 1918, Gardner says people thought it was spread through mosquitoes. And when you look at comics of the period, you'll see mosquitoes and xenophobia.
You'll often have a mosquito dressed up in a kind of toreador's cape, which is odd, given that mosquitoes had little, if anything, to do with the flu and its spread.
These days, you see coronavirus depicted as the bad guy from the horror movie Hellraiser, whose head is covered with pins. Someone dressed up as him to pretend to be coronavirus on a satirical news show in Egypt.
Corona, Or as a deceptively cute animated blob bouncing around on Stephen Colbert's online show, tuning out the news.
You know, when you become a virus, all you want is to touch as many people as possible, and I have, all thanks to these pieces of garbage.
I was quite surprised how endearing the character was.
M.K. Serwick is a nurse and a scholar of medical cartoons. She says during the HIV epidemic in the 1980s, AIDS got pictured as a monster in the shadows. That's partly because at first we did not know what that virus looked like.
What's been remarkable about COVID-19 is that from the beginning, we had a visual of the pathogen.
Which is why we picture it now the way it really looks, as a globe with a crown of spikes. Making it cute strikes a balance, Serwick says, in helping communicate a message about public safety and to suggest that coronavirus might be something we'll eventually be able to tackle and control. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
Conservative media outlets, including Fox News, have come under heavy criticism, not just for downplaying the threat of the coronavirus early on, but for playing up the anger at stay-at-home orders. Here's Fox host Jeanine Pirro speaking last week as protesters rallied in Michigan.
They want to keep us locked in our homes. They want to keep us away from churches and synagogues. They want to make sure we don't go back to work. They don't get it. The American spirit is too strong, and Americans are not going to take it.
For more, we're joined by NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy.
So we just heard Fox News, Jeanine Pirro there on the stay-at-home protests. InfoWars has gone even further. Here's Owen Schroyer, host of the show War Room.
This is the time where we have to reclaim our country. This is it. You're going to have to make a sacrifice, okay? For some, it may be nothing. For some, it may be a sacrifice of just not wearing a mask outside. Others may have to take an arrest or get a fine. But this is the battle. I mean, if you don't make a sacrifice, you have nothing.
David, how much has right-wing media, including InfoWars, given these protests a boost?
You know, these protests are not enormous. It's not like the Tea Party movement that you saw in 2010, in which conservative media and Fox significantly played a role as well. But I think they are given some legitimacy as an expression of some sort of significant public sentiment that far outstrips what you're seeing in public opinion polls, and what you're seeing, in fact, by the very fact that so much of America is shut down. People are voting and protesting in some ways by staying at home, some willingly, some grudgingly. But I think that you're seeing legitimacy given here. I think that you're seeing people being exposed to this as a part of legitimate dissent and debate in American society. And I think that, you know, if conservative media and major outlets stand by this, you will start to see more of it bubble up, probably as an expression of partisan identity and support for the president from those who hold those beliefs most strongly.
These outlets, including Fox News, have also been accused of downplaying the risk of the pandemic, especially early on. Here's Jesse Waters on Fox News on a February episode of Fox and Friends.
I'm not afraid of the coronavirus, and no one else should be that afraid either.
I'm gonna hold my hand.
not yet. I have people calling me from in the middle of the country. Their property is surrounded by acres. They live in the middle of nowhere, and they're asking me about the coronavirus. Are you crazy? What are they scared for?
So that was in February. This is Rush Limbaugh on radio just last Friday.
People instinctively know now that
however bad this is, it isn't as bad as they all told us. Not one model has been even close to correct, and everything the medical and health experts have implemented or advised to be implemented have been based on these erroneous models.
David, your thoughts on this, because a lot of people have blamed conservative media for downplaying this to the point where their relatives have gotten sick and even died because they were listening.
You've seen news articles where people have attested and made the contention that, that indeed, just as you say, that relatives believed in what Fox had to say or believed in what conservative media figures had to say, or some more conservative public officials might say, in seemingly dismissing the risk that this pandemic poses and then succumb to the disease themselves. There's a study out that makes a claim. It has not been peer reviewed, but it's done by respected scholars, some of whom are based at the University of Chicago, that actually viewers of Sean Hannity were more likely to be exposed to the disease than viewers of Tucker Carlson, who actually took it more seriously and earlier. And I think that even if that study may have to be closely scrutinized for how it plays out, it has, as I said, not yet been fully peer-reviewed yet. I think there is some notion of the fact that people's beliefs are shaped by what they consumed. You know, if you're swimming in these waters, if these are the conversations people are having, saying, well, we have to balance freedom and liberty, mm-hmm. and dissent is important, and we shouldn't just blindly accept what public officials are saying, to the point where you're dismissing then what the overwhelming evidence seems to show, which is that Rush Limbaugh's right, that models aren't perfect and have not been accurate or even always in quite the right neighborhood. But the overall notion that it's being brought down by people not mingling, by people not being in public, seems absolutely borne out by everything we've seen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, part of what the media does is scrutinize, it fosters debate, but it also has to present the public with information it needs to live their lives.
David, Fox News also doesn't appear to be backing down from embracing hydroxychloroquine, even as President Trump has been talking about it less. This is Laura Ingraham just last night speaking with Jeff Collier, a doctor and former Republican governor of Kansas.
Physicians themselves are taking hydroxychloroquine as a prophylactic against themselves coming down with this virus and perhaps getting seriously ill. Dr. Collier, you know, what about that? They're prescribing it to themselves. It's already happening.
No, it's already happening.
David, just a few seconds here, but it's surprising that they're still doing that.
What you're seeing there is one of Fox's most outspoken figures responding to the network's own efforts to rein in its stars a little bit, to be a little bit more responsible, to acknowledge the risks as the public criticism is built up, as even a top official at Fox this week tried to take steps to pull people back a bit. You're seeing some of their stars saying, no, you can't control us. You're going to pull us in. We're going to push back and try to repeat some of the possibly damaging things we've said in the weeks that preceded this.
That is NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik. Well, one way to limit time in public is through technology, using apps to buy groceries or get things delivered. But that can be a challenge for senior citizens. Joining us now by Skype is Joseph Coughlin, who's the director of the MIT Age Lab. Joe, welcome to Here and Now.
Hey, it's great to be here, Jeremy. Thank you.
Well, and I should start by saying this is not just a problem for senior citizens. People of all ages can struggle with this. But what are some of the reasons that older adults might not adopt new technologies, like using smartphone apps to order groceries or do banking online?
Well, you know, my colleagues at the MIT Age Lab have been studying the technology older adult interface for, frankly, two decades now. And there's a number of reasons, and some of them a lot of people may not like. The mythology, if you will, is that older adults do not like technology. They're not willing to adopt or adapt to it. Well, for some of us, that's true. And generally, we find that those people, frankly, were not high adopters when they were in their 20s and 30s, regardless of what the technology was. Hmm. One of the greatest barriers, however, is that the technology itself is being designed by the very young for the very young. So give me an example.
What does that mean? How do you design something for the very young?
Well, if you think about it, one of the reasons why younger people pick up technology, or at least we think they do, faster is because, remember, to them, everything is novel. And so, therefore, it's worth a try. They have, shall we say, no mental model or way that they've ever done anything differently. So they're willing to try. With an older adult, remember, they've got decades of finding ways of doing things that, frankly, have worked out just fine. The bar is higher. in terms of, is it worth my time, my hassle, and my money to adopt your new technology?
Well, the other thing is that it can be difficult for a younger person to explain to the parent or the grandparent how to use this new technology. It can be frustrating for everyone involved. What's a better way for seniors to learn how to use new technology?
Well, actually, if you think about it, it's the way that even younger people learn, which is few of us, if you will, have an intuitive understanding of technology. We learn through peers. We look over the shoulder of friends. Hey, what's that app? How did you do that? Let me show. Older adults have a far smaller circle, if you will. So one of the things we may want to think about is help older adults realize, or frankly, people of any age, generally speaking, you can't break it. Go ahead, experiment. If it doesn't work, shut it off and try it again. Secondly, there are resources out there. I would direct many people to the AARP website, an organization called OATS for Older Adults and Technology Services, as well as, frankly, Jeremy, you and I know it, there's always a 12-year-old kid on YouTube in his mother's basement that knows how to write code or do whatever it is better than you and I. And then probably the other part is don't forget about friends and mentors, whether they're older or younger. That's probably your biggest trusted source of people that will help you and understand you at the same time.
Now, part of the reason that some seniors may not want to use, let's say, a grocery delivery app is that they may think it is risky to put credit card information in there. They don't trust it. What's behind that?
Absolutely. In fact, trust is a major issue, although it is counterintuitive. Do you know that the younger you are, the less trusting you are in other people and institutions as well? Which is kind of funny, given the fact that younger people are more likely to get in a car with a stranger on an app than older people. For older adults that may have that fear, and it is justified, fraud and theft is out there. What I would suggest is they get one credit card that is dedicated just for that purpose. It does not have that big a credit line, and the brand of the card is known for being very defensive of your privacy and your protection.
So we're all learning a lot of new things in this crisis that will probably last for the long term. I, for example, have learned how to make avocado toast. It's not very difficult, but it's really delicious. Do you think that senior citizens may learn new technologies because they have to right now, and that will improve their lives in the long run?
Exactly. This gets over the hump, if you will, of, do I really need it? It's a hassle. This actually has accelerated technology use and service adoption to the home in ways we've never thought about before. At the Age Lab, we have an entire program dedicated to managing the home as a service, not just a place. So whether it's telehealth, food delivery, entertainment, social connection, this is becoming the new normal, whether you're 20 or whether you're 120.
That is Joseph Coughlin, who's director of the MIT Age Lab. Thank you so much for joining us.
And you know, in any other year, tonight's NFL draft would be one of the biggest events on the calendar. Thousands of fans would show up in person to cheer or boo as their teams select the nation's top college football players. Of course, this is not a normal year. Tonight's draft will be done remotely, sort of like a huge Zoom meeting with millions of dollars at stake. For more, we're joined by Mike Pesca, Here and Now sports analyst. He's also the host of the daily podcast, The Gist, on Slate.com. And Mike, how is this going to work?
Well, they hope it's going to work. So the original idea for the draft before coronavirus hit was a Las Vegas spectacular with the draftees riding in boats on the Bellagio Lake. This is a different kind of extravagant or ridiculous. There are going to be hundreds of different videos that have been shipped out by ESPN, which will be broadcasting the draft. And people, the draftees, the team executives will be filming themselves. That is what we, the viewers, will get to see in terms of technology they'll be using. It's not actually Zoom. Zoom's a little insecure or a lot insecure, according to some media reports. Mm-hmm. They use a Microsoft application where I swear every day they send out three different notifications about just how secure this application is. So when you get right down to it, the draft is an exercise in human resources, and it seems like a TV extravaganza, but it doesn't have to be. So I think the bare bones of telling college players who they'll be playing for, that will go smoothly. What we get to see might be a little glitchy.
Yeah, I imagine, though, that the TV ratings are going to be huge.
because there is nothing else, right? So as a baseline, right. Look at the WNBA TV ratings, and the WNBA draft was an all but looked on thing. It more than doubled this year because there was some actual sports content that wasn't a documentary, that wasn't, you know, just replaying an old game. So ESPN's ratings, of course, have fallen tremendously, to say nothing of the NFL networks. They are salivating to have an actual piece of programming with some drama and uncertainty involved. It might not be a sport, but it's close.
Yeah, you know, my husband has ESPN on still. Like, he's watching it as if some sort of game is just going to appear out of nowhere, watching all those documentaries and stuff. But, you know, the bigger question, is there even going to be an NFL season this fall for the players who do get drafted tonight?
Well, the NFL thinks there is, and the White House wants there to be. And Anthony Fauci gave some interviews where he laid out plans where it could happen. And the NFL also knows that other leagues have to go first. So the MLB season, the truncated NBA season, maybe they'll sequester or quarantine their players, test them repeatedly, play before empty stadiums, maybe a third filled stadiums. But of course, a lot of that is predicated on what all of society wants, which is enough and sufficient and accurate enough testing to make sure that their interactions don't lead to the spread of the virus.
You know, I mean, a lot of folks are asking the question, will sports survive in general? I assume it will once we get back to normal. I mean, it's just a part of the human condition to want to connect in this way. But what are your thoughts in the 30 seconds?
Yes, it's the most sought after. I mean, if you compare the size of the business of professional sports, it seems big and the players get big salaries, but it pales to other businesses. Yet so it's so often talked about, I think that we will want and find a way to have our sports.
Yeah, Mike Pesca is Here and Now sports analyst. He also hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
If you need a break, maybe something to lift your spirits, singer-songwriter Jason Mraz is back with some new music.
Look for the good.
Look for the Good is the just-released reggae-flavored title track on Mraz's album, which will be coming out in June. And Jason Mraz is with me now on a very good quality microphone in his home studio in California. Jason, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me on your program. It's a pleasure.
I know that you, as all of us are, you're joining us from home, from your home studio. How have you been holding up during this pandemic?
You know, I think during this pandemic, we're all asked to master what's in front of us. And for me, it's learning how to both handle my career, which is typically an outward expression out there in the world. And I'm also learning how to master patience, because that's what's in front of me here at home. You know, I love to stay creative. I love to stay active. And now that I'm being, you know, we're all being asked to stay home, I'm learning how to master that patience, and, you know, as well as some household chores and boxes and things that I've put off until, quote unquote, someday. Mm-hmm. I think a month of some days has finally arrived.
Right. And when you say master patience, what does that mean? How does that play out?
Oh, I easily distract myself with just more busyness, more doing, more music, more tours, more projects. And in this case, we're really being asked to consume less and really reserve those resources for the essential workers. You know, if I were busying myself driving around, flying around, creating things, I feel like I would be just taking from the economy. I'd be taking from my community, and I don't want to do that.
Well, and I have to say, as people listen to Look for the Good, you can hear the sort of quintessential Jason Mraz upbeat outlook. And I have to say one thing that I'm noticing, and I'm lucky not to have gotten sick yet from COVID-19. I still have a job. I still have income. But I've noticed that I'm having trouble sleeping pretty regularly, because probably the amount of time I'm focused on the news, which can be pretty depressing. But what about you? How are you able to stay positive and upbeat right now?
Well, I use music as my practice to help me look for the good. Music is an art of language. And in that language, I get to choose the kinds of words that I'm bringing into action. You know, and those will eventually influence or affect my thoughts. They'll affect my actions, my attitudes, and therefore my life experience can hover or dwell on the positive side. So that's where I choose to dwell. And even if I'm looking at the news and there's totally different frequencies happening on the news, I do my best to then transform, transmute, translate even what I'm experiencing in the news into something good, or to breathe life into it through music.
Now, this song, Look for the Good, is being used as part of a campaign called Food for Heroes by the mayor's office in New York City, which, of course, has been the epicenter, at least so far in the U.S., of the COVID-19 crisis. Tell us about that, this project.
The mayor of New York, his office has the fund, the mayor's fund, to advance New York City. And within that fund, they've started the Food for Heroes Fund, which is going to provide upwards of tens of thousands, hopefully 30,000 to 50,000 hot meals a month to essential healthcare workers and personnel. And they're creating a PSA to basically raise awareness about this fund, to bring dollars and awareness to the healthcare workers so they can get some hot meals. And we've lent our song to this campaign to run in the background just to amplify the message and hopefully raise the raise a vibration and awareness around their efforts. It's a beautiful thing.
Look for the Good is not the only song on here that has a reggae feel to it. Most all of them do. Let's listen to another one. This is called Wise Woman.
She's a real wise woman with so much love to give. She gives so much because she stays in touch with what her truest nature is. She's a green garden goddess. She is the universe. She's out there with the planets, but she keeps it down to earth because she's a wise, wise woman.
Jason Mraza, you have fully embraced reggae. And because last time we talked about how you had a lot of different genres in your music. This time, I think you've gone full on reggae.
I have. Yeah, thanks for noticing. The reggae genre has one that has always been a great medium to sing about issues you care about. And the reggae backbeat, which is generously provided by producer Michael Goldwasser from Easy Star All Stars, he and I became friends a couple years ago and started writing songs. And last year decided to make an album together, where I've composed all the lyrics and messages to try to breathe life into issues that I think are relevant and many that I just care about on a day-to-day basis.
Is it true that your home and studio have been modeled off of Bob Marley's?
Exactly. I shouldn't say modeled architecturally, but I did tour Bob's home back in 2004 on a trip to Kingston when I was there working with Sly and Robbie on a project. And I, at that time, was a touring musician living in an apartment in Los Angeles, and I knew that between tours, I should be settling down. I should find a home, and preferably a home like the home I just saw at Bob Marley's house, which was this beautiful home that allowed he and his band and his family to all live together while they were recording or rehearsing. That little studio in the backyard, they had enough room to grow gardens and fruit trees, etc. So I bought a little house on the fringe of San Diego, about 5-acre place that had fruit trees and a little space, a little garage that could be easily converted into a studio. And so that was about 15 years ago. Never did I imagine 15 years later I would actually be making my own reggae album inspired by that event and my love of reggae since then.
And are you embraced by the reggae community, by the longtime fans of Bob Marley?
I hope so. You know, we went about this project with the utmost respect for the reggae genre. This album features a lot of different reggae styles, vintage reggae, rock steady, a little bit of dancehall, a little bit of ska, but mostly classic reggae and some pretty modern reggae and hip hop funky influences as well. But we really did our best to tribute the genre in hopes of being a bridge for people who may have never listened to reggae before, that they can then start looking at the genre and diving a little bit deeper about where we may have been inspired by our sounds.
I want to listen to one more song here from the new album. This is called Gratitude.
I thank the girls who gave the hand and showed me how to dance. And I thank the ones who turned me down and never gave me a second chance. I love
for hearts to go on their own way. They shaped my life, they made me like who I am today. They shaped my life, they made me love who I am.
So let me just finally ask you a question that I sort of can ask anyone right now. And I would ordinarily say, when do you think this lockdown is going to be over? But for you, I will say, when do you think you're going to be able to perform another concert again?
Wow, that is a good question. You know, we were actually planning on launching a tour already, selling tickets already. It was a fall tour. I've got team members saying, well, it's 50-50, but it's really hard to believe that by September, 15 people are going to want to live together on a bus and travel from town to town day after day and meet hundreds of people in small spaces. I also think the entertainment industry in general has made a huge shift, and we've learned how to operate from home. So seeing that, there's real benefits to the environment. There's real benefits to the air quality, the water quality, et cetera. So I hope it's actually a slow and thoughtful reintegration so that we can be not only mindful of each other in our health, but the continued health and restoration of the planet, because we've clearly known we've been in a climate crisis for decades. And this may actually be a surprising, unique, and necessary way of starting to address that issue as well. So I'm hoping it's a kind and gradual reintegration, not something where we just all open the doors and go right back at it, and then we cause this problem again.
That is Grammy-winning musician Jason Mraz, whose new album, Look for the Good, is out on June 19th. The single is available now. Jason, thank you so much for joining us, and stay safe.
Jeremy, thank you so much. You too.
And for more information on Food for Heroes, you can go to hereandnow.org.
And while many of us are eager to get back to a normal life, scientists still very much urge us to maintain social distancing to slow the spread of the coronavirus. Researchers at the University of Texas at Austin have been looking at geolocation data on cell phones to track social distancing measures throughout the country, and their research shows it's working. Joining us now is Lauren Ansel Myers. She is a professor of biology and statistics who leads UT's COVID-19 modeling consortium. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yes. So based on the data you've collected, what grade would you give the U.S. overall when it comes to social distancing efforts right now?
I think we would give the U.S. as a whole a pretty good grade. And we can see that in the shapes of the COVID-19 mortality curves that we're projecting. So in many states across the United States and the United States as a whole, it seems as if the rate at which new deaths are occurring has declined, and those curves are starting to dissipate. And that is because of the effectiveness of social distancing. People are really cutting off contacts with each other in a way that is stopping the disease from spreading.
Can you tell us a little bit more about your research, how cell phone data is being collected and used in this way to find these findings?
Sure. So the model that you're talking about is one in which we're trying to project 3 weeks into the future how many people will die from COVID-19 in every state in the country and the U.S., and the way we make these projections is by using a model of how deaths will increase as a function of how much people are coming in contact with one another. So how do we figure out how much people are coming in contact with one another? Well, we can't see that directly, but what we can see is the geolocation data from a company called SafeGraph, and they collect geolocation, anonymized geolocation data. They aggregate it from tens of millions of cell phones from around the country. So it's really rich data. And this organization is providing this kind of data to researchers across the country to support better, more data-driven modeling of COVID-19. And what that data tell us is how much time people are spending at home, how often they're going to places like grocery stores and pharmacies and other public spaces where they might come in contact with each other and spread disease. And what we see from the data all across the country is that over the last month, the amount of time people spend at home, how often they make trips to these points of interest where they could come in contact with each other, The time at home has increased dramatically, and the rate at which people are gathering in these places is decreased dramatically. And so that is direct input into our model and leads us to project the continuing decline in COVID-19 deaths for the next few weeks. However, we can only see what people are doing up till today, right? And so we don't know how that behavior will change next week or next month. So that means we can only project about 3 weeks out what will happen with COVID-19 deaths.
Right. It's amazing what we can learn from our cell phone data and usage. It can be uplifting for some to hear that social distancing is working based on your findings. But for others, they might hear this and actually think, oh, okay, well, it's not as high as it could have been. There's a lot of people who may think, well, I can go back to a normal life. What do you say to that?
That second way is unfortunately the wrong way to interpret it. What the results say is that it has taken extensive social distancing in order for us to mitigate this terrible threat in our populations. And so what this really says is, yes, I mean, it's uplifting in the sense that we can make choices. We can make decisions that not only protect our own health, but protect the health of everyone in our communities, everyone in our country. But unfortunately, we have to keep making that decision. We have to continue to take precautions that either prevent contacts between people or really reduce the possibility of transmission if we do have to come in contact with each other. And if we relax that now, if we go back to life as normal, unfortunately, this virus will just start spreading at the rate that it originally started spreading when it first arrived in our cities.
You're reviewing this data, as you mentioned, state by state. Can you give us some examples of what you're seeing in terms of when a peak may come? Are some areas closer than others?
Well, we have an online website that shows the projections of our model. And so you can actually look at your own state and see where you are. A lot of the big states that have experienced very substantial numbers of deaths and cases already, many of them now look like it's very likely they've passed their peak or will do so within the next 2 weeks. So it's looking positive, you know, in many states around the country at this point. But like I said, that could change very easily if people's behavior changes.
That's Lauren Ansel Myers. She leads the COVID-19 Modeling Consortium at the University of Texas at Austin. And we will have a link to her research at hereandnow.org. Lauren, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And in taking a deeper look at Lauren's projections, we zoomed in on Texas, where she lives, and the UT model shows that the probability is 64% that the peak has already passed. The confidence jumps as the days go on. In 2 weeks' time of additional social distancing in Texas, the model finds the probability at 94%. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.